Hello, good evening, and welcome. I am Samuel Trapp. This is Damn Radio. Damn glad to have you here tonight. This is International Flavor, and it is Sunday, which happens to be the day before Monday. Happy Father's Day to all of you fathers out there, and I'm very glad to have you joining me on the program. And decent amount of topics today. I've been chasing a couple of things and news that I've been following. I have been very much interested in the nonsense going on in the world today, and I'm not happy about it. I'm, in fact, a little bit grumpy about all the issues going on in the world. I wonder if I've turned my Discord too low. Let me have a look at that and see. That is quite possible that I need to turn it up just a tad. How about that? I think that's coming in a little bit better and still not too loud. So I like that. And I just want to make sure that all the sound is coming in okay. And the meters appear to be even, so that's a good thing. So anyway, I have been very much watching the, for lack of a better word, I will call them antics, game playing of the international folks all over the world that I just don't like. I don't like this bombing of people, and I don't want to see it, and I don't want to hear about it, but it is a fact, and it is a sad fact that that is indeed happening today. And the news is full of stuff like this right now. And my lecture for today, I suppose, if you want to call that, is very similar to the lecture about what is going on in Ukraine and Russia. Ukraine, over the weekend, bombed Tatarstan, you know. I don't know what potential good that does. I don't want to say that I support what Russia is doing, because I don't want that to be misinterpreted. But I understand why they started what they are doing. And I understand that at this point they feel it is a war for their survival as a culture, as a group, and that they don't deserve to be treated like the enemies that the world has treated them as. And if you continue in this way, well, sometimes people got to answer. I was quite distressed, as I may have told you last Thursday, because I think a lot of these things have been occurring for a while, that the Israelis wanted to engage in what they like to call a preemptive strike, meaning we're doing it because if we don't, they'll strike us first. I don't understand the logic behind that, although plenty of folks in the U.S. government spheres are attempting to mirror those statements. And now Iran is saying that they're responding in kind. And what are you going to do now? Now this is now justifying retroactively what Israel is doing. And I don't know. I have a seriously hard time with this type of circular logic, right? So you preemptively hit somebody so that you can say, well, we were afraid they might do it to us, so we did it to them first. Then the person responds and you go, see, told you so. Told you they were going to attack us. Told you they were the big bad wolf. And I disagree with that thought concept completely. Now, the Middle East has been less than warmongering over the past decade. It hasn't been as horrible as I recall it being. It always seems the people rattling sabers are the Israelis. Always the ones that say the same thing I accuse Zelensky of doing. Well, we got Big Brother behind us. Big Brother's never going anywhere. Big Brother Trump, Big Brother USA, they're always going to be with us. And therefore, you know, we can do whatever we want. They wouldn't act this way if they didn't have some reason to believe that way. And the same thing goes with the Z-Man. And I just don't like it. And I don't know. We're going to get to a couple of articles on that I'm going to go through for you. But Iran is now threatening and preparing, they say, to shut down Israel's war machine. And it's hard to think that Israel doesn't have a war machine with what we've seen over the last year and a half. Now, I'm no fan of what occurred in the attacks, you know, the Hamas-style attacks from October of year before last. I'm not for that. But I'm also not for responding in kind and destroying an entire culture based upon it. At some point, you have to speak up for the people being slaughtered and killed, okay? And I feel the same way, that at some point, we're going to have to do something serious in between Russia and Ukraine to get that to end. But now they're just getting ramped up. I watched an interesting snippet today about the old Z-Man, the Green Goblin, as he is sometimes called. And the old Green Goblin is now frightened. He came out, and it was I'm not going to play it, but I still could get to it if I wanted to, and talk about his discussion of, well, man, now the U.S. is going to forget all about us for sure. And parts of Europe are going to forget us about us now for sure. They're all going to... Only be given money to Israel. And what about us? What about me? What about me? Where's my money? Where's my more arms? Where's my stuff? You know, we're dying here too. And by the way, they are losing more and more territory. Russia is advancing daily, adding kilometers, adding new small towns, new villages, new tree lines, new farmland that they're moving. They're coming down into Sumy, doing pretty well. They're going over into Dnipropetrovsk. They're crossing various rivers. They're blowing up bridges so that Ukraine can't use them to resupply. And they are winning. And I'm not sure what they expected. Well, I know what they expected. They expected that Big Brother would be there to save them. And you know my thoughts on that. And I don't know. Israel is asking the U.S. to join its attacks on Iran. I hope that doesn't happen. I truly do. We have no business over there in that either, I feel. Equally as strong about that. Let them resolve their own disputes. That's it. It has nothing to do with us. And I don't know where to go with that. There's articles about sanctions. There's articles about Putin wishing Trump a happy birthday. That'll be a fun one when we get to that. U.S. Republicans are investigating the California governor and L.A. mayor over riots. That could be fun. the EU nation, Croatia. Diplomat and his wife received injuries during ballistic missile strikes in Tel Aviv. There's a real opinion piece that I'm definitely going to share with you, saying that Israel doesn't go rogue. It always strikes with Pentagon green light. That's a bother to me. And Iran could strike American military bases in the Middle East. There's some BRICS news today. Well, it was actually yesterday, but about Vietnam becoming a 10th BRICS partner country. That could be exciting and very interesting. And there's another feature that says, kind of, I love these smart ass article topics. The US is about to hit add to cart button for another forever war. Now I find that amusing. I like it. And I'm trying to figure out which one to start with. I think I'm going to go with the a little bit of yawning, rather tired this weekend. By the way, I did want to point out that if you felt like calling in today, you're certainly welcome to do so at 573-746-8020. And I'd be happy to converse with you and see where we go from here. But I did want to mention that watching the news topics today, it seemed a tiny bit odd to me even that Ukraine, which has been dominating the news for 3 years, when talking about on the international level and everything going on, and there's always a number of articles about Ukraine and Russia and Zelensky, they're now being pushed aside. And I can see why Zelensky is bombing Tatarstan. I don't agree with it, but he's trying to stay relevant. And how's he going to stay relevant? He's going to keep on bombing. He's going to keep on attacking. He's going to keep on begging Germany for Taurus missiles to strike inside of Russia. That's the plan, friends and neighbors. And he's got no other choice, truthfully. I mean, what's he going to do? He is going to have to continue what would you call it? Clamor for attention. He is clamoring for attention and relevance. And he isn't getting any, which for him is a sad affair. He just isn't getting any attention, and that is unfortunate for his part. So I wanted to talk, why don't we do the lighter-hearted one first, and do the Putin wishing me a happy birthday on June 14th. And I know of two people with birthdays on June 14th who I also wish happy birthday. And I did it on the 14th as well, so I'm really not late. But happy birthday to you. I don't sing, but well, I do sing, but not here. I'm not going to do it. But the fact is that Putin wished the old Trumpster a happy birthday. The U.S. and Russian presidents held another hour-long phone conversation on Trump's birthday. How about that? U.S. President Trump revealed that his Russian counterpart, Mr. President Vladimir Putin, Vladimir Vladimirovich, if you wish to call him that, and Vladimir Vladimirovich wished Donald Jayevich, I guess it would be, he wished him happy birthday during a phone conversation on Saturday. Shortly after the call, the U.S. president took to Truth Social to provide the details You know he can't go with, 10 minutes without providing some detail on Truth Social. President Putin called this morning to very nicely wish me a happy birthday, but to more importantly, talk about Iran, a country he knows well. We talked at length. Trump, who turned 79 on Saturday, wrote, "The two presidents spent much less time discussing the Ukraine conflict," he noted, adding that the topic will be for next week. The call lasted about an hour. He feels, as I do, that this war in Israel-Iran should end, to which I explained his war should end also, said Trump. According to Russian presidential aide Yuri Ushakov, the conversation between Putin and Trump was meaningful, frank, and most importantly, very useful. Putin condemned Israel's strikes on Iran, noting that they occurred just before the sixth round of nuclear negotiations between Tehran and Washington, originally scheduled for the 15th, would have begun. Despite such a complicated situation, the Russian and American presidents didn't rule out a return to the negotiating track on the Iranian nuclear program, said Ushakov. The presidential aide also confirmed that Putin extended his birthday wishes to Trump, noting that both leaders expressed their satisfaction with the personal relationship that allows them to communicate in a business-like manner, as well as to seek solutions to pressing issues on bilateral and international agenda, no matter how complex those issues may be. Frankly, I agree with that. If there is anything positive to be gained from all of this, it is only going to come by the U.S. Staying communicative with Vladimir Putin. One of the things that I say was just a horror story during the Biden presidency was the absolute failure to speak to any counterpart on the Russian side of the planet. And how do you expect to resolve anything without communication? Quite unexpectedly, the last couple of days, I was working on a different project, which I won't outline to you, but it recalled to me one of the things that I did in law school. And in law school, I was a member of my university's, my law school's negotiation competition team. And it provided something that is called interest-based bargaining. It was very popular, and people who learn true negotiation, whether lawyers or not, know what I'm talking about. You may hate each other. You may have absolutely competing interests, both as an attorney and later as a real estate agent and broker. I run into positions where you have to negotiate all the time. And if you're not creative, if you're all you care about is position, and my position, a foolish participant in a dispute, like Zelensky, for example, will say, "We will never agree to something that doesn't grant a ceasefire right now." Okay, and I'm only using that because it's a simple example. We won't agree to anything that doesn't grant a ceasefire right now. Now, what is that? That is called a position. His position is, we won't negotiate until somebody gives us a ceasefire. And Russia, on the other hand, is saying, we won't negotiate, we won't give you a ceasefire until you negotiate and give us peace on lasting end of war style peace. who wants a ceasefire that isn't permanent? All it does is give you time to, those are positions. Those are positions, and everybody is embedded in their position. And everybody, that's, those are the things you throw out to the news. Those are the things you say, well, we are not doing. But those are the things that totally make your meetings in Istanbul foolish and pointless. Because if you give in on those points without giving a reason why, well, you've lost your position. You can't save face if you agree to it. So Russia is just going to make Ukraine capitulate. Ultimately, I think that's what's going to happen if they don't do something sooner or change the way they negotiate. And instead of looking at positions, and they're trying, they're throwing out things like exchanging bodies. They're throwing out things like swapping prisoner exchanges, but they aren't doing anything else. An interest-based bargaining approach, if you're interested in what that is, would be something like this. You do some investigation, and it's more of an explanation than anything to explain why you do what you do. But if you are foolishly and unwaveringly entrenched in your position, you'll die with that position on one side or the other. And you recognize no gains for either side. There could be opportunity for both sides to benefit and profit. And that is where interest-based bargaining comes in. So instead of looking at the position, look at the why behind that position, right? And then see if you can't figure out something that will work together. And what both of these people are missing is the sheer number of people dying. I know they know that. But the interest in Ukraine is they got to save face or they're going to continue to lose territory. They're going to continue to lose a greatly lopsided number of soldiers compared to the other. They need to save face internationally. They need to do something to start to rebuild. There are opportunities for, I don't know what, for mutual wins. Way back when I heard one, and it was actually an interesting thought. And it was actually brought up by Donald Trump. And what interest-based bargaining does is it requires you to get a little creative. And way back when Donald Trump was it really wasn't that long ago, a couple of months ago, all the talk was the minerals deal. Was getting the minerals deal. If the U.S. gets the minerals deal, we can give you something more. Well, that could have been an effort to get something creative, some discussion between the two of these people. And part of that minerals deal, and part of what, whether it was Witkoff or Kellogg, I don't remember which. I doubt it was Kellogg. I don't think he's offered anything intelligent since he started being the envoy, but Witkoff has come up with some sorts of creative parts, like getting something completely out of the ordinary and saying with Trump support or floating the idea to Trump or whatever, saying something like, and I'm not saying I agree with it one way or the other, I'm saying it for the point of view of getting creative. And that was the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, and that this Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which Russia took in 2022 and is currently being monitored by the IAEA, Trump or Kellogg or both or somebody else that passed it along to them came up with an idea of, hey, this is really foolish, that people keep bombing each other's energy infrastructure, and it's doubly foolish that Ukraine wants to destroy the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant because it's the biggest nuclear power plant in Europe. Why don't we get it back up and running and split the electricity between Ukraine and Russia? And now there was something else thrown in there that the U.S. wanted to be in charge of it or something like that. And I don't remember the details, but I remember thinking at the time that perhaps that would be some sort of good, if not a resolution, at least a talking point. And of course, most of the time, these negotiators in Istanbul or wherever they happen to be, especially if they're negotiating on Truth Social or in the public media sphere, they don't have the authority of the things that they are saying. And so it is for the presidents to outline their positions and then for their negotiation teams to work out creative ideas to resolve the conflict, potentially based on the interests of both parties, more importantly, on the interests of their citizens. And both of these countries are losing a good number of people. Most of the world is very, very tired of this war, including me. I understand the Russian point of view, and in fact, I support it far more than I support the opposite side. And if you listen to me at all, you know my thought processes on this is that we have squandered tons of opportunity to not create Russia as an enemy. And we've been wrong for a while. Our experts are historically wrong in how they deal with or attempt to deal with Russia and what we do. And, we've got the wrong alleged experts for decades in Washington. But remember, an expert is somebody that is paid to tell you what you want to hear. That's what an expert is. Ask any lawyer. They know that. If I can shop for an expert, I can always find an expert to say what he wants me to hear. I'm sorry, to say what I want him to tell me. If he doesn't, I just find a different expert. And who pays for all the experts? People that want more money in Washington. So they find an alleged expert who agrees with them and gives them more money. And that's the way it's been for 50 years. And that is not the way to run a railroad, and it is certainly not the way to end a war in Ukraine. Now, by the same token, here we are watching the horror stories going on between India and Pakistan, between Iran and Israel. And, if you just take another small look, just like Ukraine poking the Russian bear, which is basically 10 times its size. That's exactly what Israel is doing. Israel has an approximate citizenry population of just under 10 million. And Iran has somewhere in the high 90s. 90 million citizens. Now, Israel has a pretty good military. Don't go thinking that Iran doesn't have a serious military capability and potential as well, because they do. If anybody's been watching at all over the last little bit of the last couple of days since Israel started its preemptive strike, Iran's been bombing back with earnest. And so now what? Here we are, third night in a row, I think. Iran and Iran clash for the third day as death tolls mount. and there are live updates coming to us on all of this. And Israel and Iran clash for the third day. At least 13 people killed in Israel and 224 in Iran. But we all know that Iran has no problem striking living quarters of people. And, you know, if there's a general in an apartment complex, there's no problem for them to take out the entire apartment building and kill a good number of people. There's, you know, if they're going to assassinate somebody, they're perfectly happy and they see nothing wrong with taking out a whole building full of citizens to do so. The end justifies the means, period. And I don't believe they're condemned enough for that sort of behavior. And there's been all kinds of anti-Israel discussion at the International Criminal Court, at the UN, at the Security Council. And there's all, I mean, it's, this is brutal no matter how you slice it. But Israel and Iran have engaged in a third day of open warfare. Both nations launching devastating attacks. You can go out to YouTube and watch tons of it. And everybody's publishing it. You know, people in right there. According to Israel's Magen David Adam Rescue Service, Iranian strikes killed at least 10 and bring the total death toll to 13. And Iran's health ministry says that 224 people were killed in Israeli strikes as of Sunday evening. The IDF, Israel Defense Force, targeted critical energy infrastructure, striking refineries in a South Pars gas field, the world's largest gas field, and an oil depot in Tehran. Iran fired a barrage of missiles at Tel Aviv, and they hit residential apartments and struck an oil refinery in Haifa. So they're both doing the same thing, and it'll just keep going back and forth. On Friday, Israeli jets bombed multiple targets across Iran, including a uranium enrichment center, and they carried out targeted assassination of several senior commanders and scientists. Iran retaliated by firing dozens of ballistic missiles into Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu said the operation called Rising Lion aims to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. If anybody starts a nuclear war here, I hate to tell you this, it's Israel. Israel starts it. Israel starts it. And you cannot reason with this type of people. You cannot reason with them. And they, you know, they're God's chosen. If they want to use a nuclear weapon, who can question them? And I say that in part facetiously, but they believe that's who they are. And a lot of people follow that same thing. I'm not necessarily certain that I don't believe that way, but I sure as hell don't think that this is acting in any way that any God that I'm a fan of would act. No way. You know, God doesn't say, you know, nuclear bomb your neighbor. No God that I know says that. And that is not for you to decide. If God wants to nuclear bomb somebody, let God do it. No offense to, you know, I don't mean that too crazy, but God didn't tell you to bomb somebody. That didn't happen. Israel launched its strikes a day after the International Nuclear Watchdog, IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, accused Iran of violating non-proliferation obligations. Iran rejects those allegations as politically motivated. The U.S. insisted it wasn't involved, although President Trump endorsed the Israel operation. Russia condemns Israel and calls for de-escalation. Russia condemns Israel strikes as of Friday. On Saturday, Putin spoke with Trump. They agreed, like we just talked about, that they should do something different about this. I don't know. I'm not liking this very much. I am not liking it one little bit. And so, I don't know, something new needs to happen. Do you remember back when the old Biden monster took the stage when he first became president, and all the talking points reflected around, the adults are now back in the room? Well, what happened to those adults? Where are they now? And I don't mean Biden. I mean all. Frankly, I thought they were all, what do you call them? Juvenile. For 4 years of juvenile. And I don't see it getting any better on the big world stage. Another thing happened that I got pretty upset about and watching too. This is really depressing, people, what our world is coming to as of this Father's Day. But another gunman dressed as a U.S. cop killed a Democrat lawmaker in the State House of Minnesota. Melissa Horton, and her husband, they were both killed, and they injured another senior legislator and his wife in separate incidents. The suspect in what Governor Tim Walz described as an act of targeted political violence remains at large and is the subject of a massive manhunt. Now, that was as of several hours ago. I haven't looked any time soon, but Hortman and her husband were shot in their home in Minneapolis, while Hoffman and his wife were shot 5 miles away in their home in Champlin. Investigators believe the suspect had dressed to impersonate a police officer, according to the media. Police were called to Senator John Hoffman's residence around 2 p.m. Saturday. Upon arrival, the officer found him and his wife shot several times, but alive. Officers from nearby Brooklyn Park checked in on other local lawmakers around 3:35. They arrived at Representative Hortman's house and saw a dark SUV in the driveway. It had red and blue flashing lights and resembled an unmarked police vehicle. A white man in a black bulletproof vest and dark clothing exited the house and opened fire on the arriving officers. After a brief shootout, he retreated back in the house and fled the scene on foot through the back door. During a search of the car, police found a manifesto identifying many lawmakers and other officials, adding that all those on the list were immediately alerted and provided with protection where necessary. Local authorities imposed a shelter-in-place order on the whole Hennepin County as the police continue their search for the subject. Later in the day, the AP claimed the suspect is identified as Vance Belter, a 57-year-old private security firm employee with military training. Governor Walz described the former Speaker of the House of the Minnesota Representatives, Hortman, as a formidable public servant and vowed to spare no resource in bringing the person responsible to justice. Isn't that a terrible story? I don't understand what's up with people. I mean, it's a nasty world out there, friends and colleagues and neighbors. And where do we go from here? Seriousness. When do I get to get on here and talk about new and cool things like travel here, travel there, travel all around the square? And now people are getting afraid to travel. I mean, like I said, I was in Tatarstan last year in Kazan, and now it's being bombed, right? Tatarstan is being bombed. What nonsense. I don't know. I don't know where to go here. I'm at a loss for words here. I wanted to tell you about this opinion piece about Israel and how we are involved in this. having been carrying out its ongoing, now this is not exactly my thought process. It's a different point of view. I've read this and I do agree with quite a bit of it, but these are not my words. These are coming from somebody else, and I want you to take it with a grain of salt, but certainly you should listen to it because it's an interesting and impactful analysis of reality here, and some of this I agree with. The title of it is called, as I told you before or indicated before, Israel doesn't go rogue, it goes with Pentagon green lights. Now, I believe that. It's, you know, it's whether it is actual or implied, nobody ever goes against Israel in American politics. They don't do it. And so the implication is, and nobody ever supports any sort of sanction for bad behavior. It's always, even if it's a preemptive strike, it will always be, you know, approved after the fact, basically, because we don't do anything about it, and we never will. And then you have people screaming that, we got to support Israel. They were attacked a year and a half ago. They've killed 40,000 people over it, and now they're killing more. When does it end? Is their goal to wipe Iran off the map? I mean, what's the goal? You can't talk to them. The talks between each other don't exist, you know? What is next? Seriously. And this is not part of the article. This is part of Sam. What is next? Is it the lobbed nuclear weapon into Iran, killing hundreds of thousands of Iranians? Is it just like us in Nagasaki? Is that the next step? Is that justified? Does that help or does that hurt? At some point, friends and neighbors, and this is a scary thought, but at some point, nuclear weapons aren't going to be able to be kept away from certain people. You know, North Korea has them. They developed them themselves. We haven't nuked the hell out of them. We're not bombing them. You know, there are other countries that have developed them over the years, and it's no longer a secret technology. It's just not. It may be a protected technology. The only non-proliferation, and I was involved in it, the only non-proliferation impacted the U.S. and Russia. Nobody does it anymore. You know, signing on, half the time, we don't even follow it. You know, who's following non-proliferation? Not enough people there, and so you're gonna have other countries do it. And remember what happened when North Korea did it? Nothing. Sanctions. There you go. And by the way, what are you gonna do with every single country as each and every additional country comes in? What are you gonna say? All right, Israel, bomb the hell out of them with our tacit support too? Is that how it wins here? I don't know the right answer, just so you know. And so I want you to listen to this article because it's an interesting analysis. And I don't know what the right answer is. I know that I don't like war, and I know that I don't want anyone to lob a nuclear bomb at North Korea and have it drift to this side of the world, you know, and have 100,000 innocent people destroyed. I know I don't want Israel lobbing them into Iran and other Middle Eastern countries getting involved. I don't want that. And if you do want that, well, you need to have your head examined. to put it mildly, there's got to be a different answer than bombing the crap out of each other. But anyway, here's the article. Having been carrying out its ongoing genocide of Palestinians for almost 2 years, wrecking Lebanon and Syria, repeatedly assaulting Iran and Yemen, and using subversion of Western political, economic, intellectual, and media elites to stifle opponents whenever they speak, Israel has now launched its most serious effort yet to cripple or destroy Iran, its last remaining opponent with the potential to do it serious harm. As Russia has stated, Israel's attack on Iran is criminal. It violates the UN Charter and international law. In general, in particular, it does not fulfill a narrow, and rightly so, legal criteria for a justifiable defensive preemptive strike. Israel's shameless attempts to deploy this phrase to shield its actions are purely information warfare. They are insultingly brazen to everyone. Propaganda that can work only on the willingly obtuse. Don't be obtuse, people. And as absurd as the repulsive Israeli habit of trying to pass off genocide, including by starvation, as self-defense. Incidentally, against this background, it comes as no real surprise that Israeli tactics against Iran have included the same perfidious, as in literally technically criminal under the laws of armed conflict, the same method recently deployed by Zelensky and his Western helpers. Israel, as well, used sneak drone attacks from inside its opponent's territory. In reality, if any state has good cause for claiming the right to a preemptive strike, in this case, it is Iran. Because the core criteria for a military strike to be considered preemptive is that it must disrupt an imminent enemy attack. With Israel and its U.S. symbiont recently not having let a day go by without threatening Iran with pretty much the assault that has now happened, Tehran would have an excellent evidence document to show that an Israeli and thus Western attack was imminent upon Iran. Yet especially after more than a year and a half of live-streamed Zionist colonial genocide carried out by Israel and the West, we know that international law counts for very little in the hellish rules-based world the value-concerned West has made. Now, I agree absolutely with that paragraph, that the rules only apply if you're applying them to others. And we never follow them, this rules-based world. The rules never apply to us. We bomb the crap out of whoever we want, and then we say, well, gee, we had to, and that's that. So I disagree with what Israel is doing. I think there had to have been other alternatives, especially with the 15th being the time that these talks were alleged to be continuing with support from Russia. Instead, one side, Israel, arguably with the U.S.'s tacit approval, bombs the crap out of Iran. I'm not liking this very much. Continuing with the article. Hence, the key question is not if Israel could possibly have a right to act as it does. That's a no-brainer. Absolutely not. But unfortunately, that doesn't help its victims. Israel is impunity embodied. Among all the monstrous states that modern history has witnessed that commit horrific crimes, none has been getting away with mass murder like Israel, except perhaps the U.S. Indeed, as the Israeli dissident and genocide expert Roz Segal recently explained, the sense that Israel is above the law is a key factor in how so many Israelis function and often enjoy themselves as merciless mass murderers. That's why the real question, the one that is relevant in the world as it really is why Israel can do what it is doing. And there's a short one-answer word to that question. America. Other states of the West, as well as the EU Monster Association, and the Middle East are also complicit in Israeli atrocities. But in terms of power, it is Washington that is decisive. Israel can commit its endless crimes and never face consequences only because of blind U.S. support. Just try to imagine a state as territorially and demographically tiny and geopolitically precarious as Israel, displaying so much aggression but without American backing. Exactly. There's nothing to imagine because such a state would be long gone. Yet in the case of Israel's latest outrage, Washington is claiming that it did not participate in it. Sort of. Secretary Rubio wants us to believe that Israel's assault was unilateral and the U.S. was not involved. Is there anyone left naive enough to not understand two simple facts? Namely, Washington lies easily and without hesitation, and the U.S.-Israel symbiosis is so firm and pervasive that an Israeli strike against Iran, especially of this magnitude, without American connivance and input, is inconceivable. You keep using that word. I don't think it means what you think it does. Remember that, Princess Bride? Anyway, but let's set aside the obvious big lie. That's just the U.S. being its old U.S. self. What's more interesting is that even on its own terms, the official American position simply makes no sense. Washington implausibly claims it played no role in Israel's criminal attack on Iran. Mainstream media in the U.S. and establishment mouthpieces such as Bloomberg and the Washington Post even go so far as to pretend that President Trump's officially still ongoing negotiations with Iran may have been disturbed by Israel's oh-so-independent strike. They still uncritically quote Trump as voicing opposition to an Israeli attack as recently as the day before the attack. For Bloomberg, that means that Israel struck in apparent defiance of Trump. Oh, really? The leader didn't know defense, right? That's funny because by now Trump himself has admitted he knew about the attack. Perversely blames Iran and not Israel and calls on Tehran, in essence, to surrender before Israel hits it so hard that nothing is left of Iran. And all this while Israel has already threatened another 2 weeks of operations, or even more, namely, as long as it takes. Trump, consequently, has not only sided unambiguously with Israel, but has also signaled that he is fine with Israeli friends battering Iran as long as they like, including to the point of extermination. That is, Washington's absurdly incredible official story is first, Israel massively defied America's declared policy, second, the U.S. does not really mind, and third, quite to the contrary, Washington just loves being made a fool of in front of the world as long as it's done by Israel. It loves it so much, in fact, that the American response is to immediately side with Israel without limits, writing out a blank check for its defiant friends to do whatever they want, because as Trump has assured those who have apparently defied him, not only can they hammer away at Iran to their heart's content, but in addition, the U.S. will always defend them against Iran in case the latter should strike back. Even Washington's lies are revealing. In this case, the lie of not being involved casts a sharp light on just how uninhibited the U.S. elite is by now in publicly subordinating everything, including the interests of ordinary Americans, to Israel and its American lobby. And I agree wholeheartedly with that. Our interests have nothing to do with this on either side. The truth is, of course, that the U.S. is deeply involved in this aggression against Iran. After Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria, the undead neocons are finally getting to the last victim on the old murder board. The lie is that the U.S. pretends not to be involved, and the ultimate unintentional reveal of the whole affair is that Washington's elites think a lie implying that they are absolutely obedient to Israel, even when directly defied by it, is a good enough story. For absolute craven submission to Israel is now considered normal. And that actually is a fundamental truth about America as it really is. I don't agree with all of that, but I do agree with a lot of that. And it is unbelievably obtuse to believe that America had nothing to do with it or didn't know anything about it until after the fact. But oh, by the way, it's okay. Keep on trucking. Keep on keeping on. You need any more bombs? We'll happily supply them. You know, hate for you to run out. We love it when people do what we wouldn't do ourselves, and we can always blame a third party in the public opinion poll because most Americans really aren't watching anyway. And they can all sit there and do the same thing we did for how long now with Ukraine? Oh, it's the big bad wolf. The big bad wolf's across the border and Russia's the bad guy. Russia will always be the bad guy. Russia has been the bad guy for neocons for a very long time. And who else is a bad guy? Iran. Who's next? If this is the last one on the list, maybe there won't be anybody else. But I'm not so sure that others in the Middle East are going to put up with it. I wanted to find some articles from the Turkish realm. Makes me wish I spoke Turkish. Nonsense. I had an article I was going to read you from the Washington Post, but they won't let me read it without paying. And I'm not paying these guys. What are you, nuts? I'm not paying that. There's not enough content in there that I'm interested in seeing. Maybe I can get it for free on JR's computer here. I don't know. Maybe I'll have to pull it up. But that's, you know, we got a lot of war going on. Things aren't getting less warlike. They're instead getting more warlike everywhere. It is escalating everywhere, and it's not right. This is nonsense. Here is something financial, and you know what? Before we get to that, I'm going to tell you about this Tutter stand because I visited it last year. I've been there a number of times, and I like Tutter stand. People are good. There's where they make the Kamaz trucks that are probably the most famous Russian vehicles. And Kamaz would be an equivalent over here, would be something like Caterpillar. And there's large factories that do it. And so here's the Ukrainians And a Ukrainian drone attack in the Republic of Tatarstan has resulted in one fatality and multiple injuries. During the interception of the UAV, debris struck a checkpoint building at an automotive plant in the Yelabuga district, killing a worker. 13 people were injured in total. One is in critical condition. The crash triggered a fire at the scene, which was extinguished. Ukrainian forces have intensified drone strikes recently, targeting border regions and deeper within Russia. National air defense systems routinely intercept dozens or even hundreds of hostile drones a day, and falling debris continues to pose risks to civilians and infrastructure. Ukraine has intensified drone raids since May. The attacks peaked during the final week of May when 2,300 unarmed aerial vehicles were shot down. Tell you what, the Ukrainians are, that is their only area of, I suppose you'd call it, of something positive to show the world, is in their infrequent drone strikes inside of Russia. And that's all they have, because they're losing unbelievably. They're losing fantastically all along the front line. And toward that end, a detailed breakdown of the new offensive that's reshaping the battlefield from Sumy to Dnepropetrovsk. I no longer really watch the rest of the battlefields. I'm watching Sumy and Dnepropetrovsk, because Russia has already taken the entire Zaporizhia area, the entire Kharkiv area, I'm sorry, Kherson area, the entire Lugansk and Donetsk, the former Donbass areas. And they've had Crimea in total since 2014. And so those, they just whittle away at what's left, but they're already at well over 90% of all of those four that I mentioned. But it was only within the last month that they crossed into Sumy and into Dnepropetrovsk, and they're getting their butts handed to them, okay? As of the spring sun gives way to the heat of summer, a new phase of the military campaign has begun to unfold across the front line. An initiative belongs to Russia. After months of attritional warfare, Russian forces have launched a sweeping spring-summer offensive that is delivering tangible results. From the borderlands of Sumy to the contested hills of Chasiv Yar and the approaches to Dnepropetrovsk, the tempo has shifted decisively. Ukraine is battered and overextended. It is struggling to contain simultaneous breakthroughs across multiple sectors of the front. The silence of Western media around these developments underscores the magnitude of what is happening on the ground. A coordinated advance is in motion. It's methodical, strategic, and effective. Sumy, establishing a buffer zone. After the liberation of Sudza in March of 2025, the fighting quickly spilled across the border into Ukraine's Sumy region. Sudza's in Kursk, where they finally booted out the Ukrainians who were there since August of last year. And Sumy's right across the border, and it's right across the border from Belgorod. Moscow described its objective as creating a buffer zone, meaning meant to safeguard the resumption of peaceful life in Russia's Kursk region. Motivated by political considerations, Ukraine army has been trying to cling to a narrow portion across the border. And this village is called Tyotkina. And I watch this every day, trying to find out what's going to happen in Tyotkina. Tyotkina is a little village in Kursk. In fact, Kyiv has deployed some of its most experienced and ideologically committed units to this tiny stretch of the front. But rather than showcasing Ukrainian resolve, the situation in Tyotkina only underscores the growing imbalance in offensive capabilities between Ukraine and Russia. From the Russian side, Tyotkina is a logistical cul-de-sac. But for Ukraine, the village connects to a critical rear supply hub in Bielopolye. Even so, Ukrainian efforts to expand presence in the area have been nearly catastrophic. In mid-May, the commander of Ukraine's 47th Brigade came close to staging a mutiny, accusing his superiors of issuing reckless orders that lead to needless casualties. I agree with that. There's nothing strategically positive about holding Tyotkina. Elsewhere along the front, Ukrainian forces, many of them retreating from Sumy and surrounding areas where they're taking huge losses, have taken heavy losses on the retreat. This remains a strategically vital axis for Ukraine. The authorities have announced mandatory evacuations in 11 other settlements, bringing the number of evacuated towns and villages in the Sumy region to 213. And I got to tell you, in March, Russia wasn't even in Sumy. Notably, this is the first time Russian forces have entered Sumy since the spring of 2022. As of now, the Russian advances are accelerating. The front line has moved to within 20 kilometers of the city of Sumy itself. The Lyman direction is not a dead end. Lyman, also known as Krasny Lyman, is a strategic city in Donetsk with a pre-war population of 20,000. It's situated along the Kharkov-Donetsk Railway and serves as a key transportation hub in Ukraine. After brief fighting, the city fell under Russian control in 2022, but was later lost during a Kharkov offensive to Ukraine in October of that year. Today, Russian forces are intent on retaking Lyman and by cutting off a single critical road that leads northwest toward the town of Izyum. And if they can cut that road off, they get Krasny Lyman. But the current offensive seems focused on this objective. On May 15, Russian troops secured the village of Torskoye, followed by the capture of Redkodub on May 29th and 30th. Both settlements are vital defensive outposts for the Ukrainian army along the route to Lyman. From the south, Lyman is effectively sealed off by Seversky Donetsk River, that's the northern Donetsk. During the brutal fighting in 2022, neither side managed to establish a river crossing. With the evolution of drone warfare, any river assault today would be even more difficult to carry out. And so Russians are now within 10 kilometers of Lyman and 7 kilometers of Izyum, and the offensive is ongoing. Now, these are places that Russia didn't occupy at all when they were talking about, let's get together and come up with something. Vladimir Putin announced that he wanted to have a buffer zone. Remember, they were talking about even that less than intelligent nincompoop Kellogg was saying, we need a buffer zone and we'll occupy it. U.S. forces, Western NATO forces can occupy the buffer zone. Russia just needs to back off 15 kilometers and we can put Western troops in the part that Russia has already taken, and that can be Russia's buffer zone. Yeah. Who's going to go for that? Why? It's a stupid offer. Why wouldn't you offer the opposite and say, we'll take over the 15, we'll, even Russia would never go for it because they don't want NATO or Western troops in this region. They don't want them there, and rightly so from their point of view. But if anything, Kellogg should have said, well, we'll take 15 kilometers back on our side and make it a buffer zone, and we won't let any Ukrainian troops in there. How about we, you know, I don't know, wall it off, build a wall. But it's, you know, it's this, it's a huge front line. I mean, the front line extends some 1,200 kilometers, people. The other one is Konstantinivka, the site of the main offensive. Now, they were talking that they had 150,000 troops not far from Konstantinovka, I said that wrong. As of June, the stretch in front of Dzerzhinsk, also known as Turetsk, to Mirnograd, has become one of the most active battle zones. Russian forces are advancing up to 10 kilometers on a 30-kilometer-wide front, have captured 12 settlements, and are doing more than 15 kilometers of a key bypass, including Pokrovsk, to Konstantinivka. They are taking land at a, should be, a frightening pace, and we don't even talk about it over here. We want to still claim, oh, gee, Ukraine bombed Tatarstan today, so therefore they're winning. Nonsense. They're doing that so they have something positive to report, because there's nothing positive to report from the front, except another 1,000 soldiers dying every day. These Gatons suggest, now I'm back to Konstantinivka. These gains suggest that a southern encirclement of Konstantinivka, a city with a pre-war population of 67,000, may be underway. Simultaneously, fighting is intensifying on the northern flank around Chasiv Yar. The terrain in this area is a serious tactical challenge. Chasiv Yar sits on elevated ground beyond the North Donetsk-Donbas Canal, which complicates efforts to establish supply lines. This sector, among the three fronts currently in focus, has received the least attention from the media. Given its strategic positioning, the media might want to pay attention. It could emerge as a central axis for Russia's summer campaign. In the past week, Russian forces have dismantled significant Ukrainian strongholds north of the village of Zarya. The terrain here is rugged and uneven, but if Russia secures it, it opens a wide path for Russian troops to push forward toward the southern outskirts of Konstantinivka. And if they get these things, you might as well exit Sumy, Dnepropetrovsk. These are the things that's happening now. Do you remember a couple of months ago I said, if you know, and several negotiators said, I think even who's the economist, the really good, why can't I remember his name? But he has been lecturing about the same thing. If you don't agree to the four regions, well, we'll make it six. And then we'll make it eight, because, frankly, they can't do anything to stop it. Another article that I was hoping to get to today, but I'm not done with this one yet, is stating that they are now, finally, in Ukraine, if you call this positive, and I'm not so sure I do anymore, they are finally saying they're going to lower the mobilization age from 25 to 18 and start mobilizing these kids. But who's going to supervise them when they go over there? You can't send 18 to 25-year-olds over without any form of training. You know, I mean, what are they going to get? You're just going to do the same thing you did to the last piles, throw them out at the front line and be done with it? These are scary things, people. Now on to approaching the borders of the DPR. Pokrovsk, Krasnoarmeysk, is another name for that city. A city of 65,000 before the war, has been under siege since last autumn. After Russia's swift capture of nearby Novogorovka and Selidova, it appeared that Pokrovsk would fall just as quickly. But in a surprising... In a surprising pivot, Russian command redirected its main effort toward the Kurakova axis. Since the winter, Ukraine has attempted to push Russian troops back from the city, but those efforts continue to fail. Further south across Volcha River, the offensive launched last year around Kurakova and Velika Novosilka are still ongoing. Russian troops have taken control of the town of Bogatyr and several surrounding settlements. The front line now is just 3 to 15 kilometers from the Dnepropetrovsk regional borders, depending on the sector where you are. So they're almost there. An interesting development in this sector: Russia's central, eastern, and southern military groups are coordinating their offensive operations here and showing good group integration. As of June the 8th, the Russian Defense Ministry announced that units from the 90th Tank Division, part of the center group of forces, have reached the western boundary of Donetsk and are advancing into Dnepropetrovsk. Pretty soon, the Ukrainians are going to be losing Dnepropetrovsk and Sumy. There's far more in Sumy right now, but Sumy and Dnepropetrovsk are, like I said from the beginning, along the Dnepr River and likely to fall if things do not change. At some point, ultimatums have to be abandoned and reasonable interest-based bargaining efforts need to be initiated. And in an effort to, what could be more important than saving the lives of your soldiers? If they were winning, it'd be different. But all they can do is continue to send bombs into Russia because they're losing all up and down the front line. And that is the sad but real truth. So... I don't know. There was another a delivery. I think it was the second or the third. Moscow has handed over the bodies of another 1,200 fallen Ukrainian troops. There have been several exchanges already between the two sides this week. This transfer happened in line with the agreements reached at Istanbul. The sources add that Kiev has not returned any more Russian troop remains in the latest exchange. They tell you about more. The handover began midweek. Then Ukraine received 1,212 bodies on Wednesday and 1,200 more on Friday, 1,200 more today. So there's still got two more to get to the 6,000 that they were talking about. And, that continues. So something is odd with that if Ukraine really has no bodies to exchange. And again, does this make Russia the only good guys? I don't know. Maybe it's just the fact that they are advancing and Ukraine is not. It's got to be something like that because I can't think of anything else that would allow something like this to be the case. Even the first 1,200, Russia only received like 37, so 6,000. And then that story still say they have another 40,000 bodies to hand over. If Russia has, that would have been 46,000 bodies of soldiers, almost all of them from Kursk, by the way, when Russia was destroying them. Let's see. Iran, of course, after its the strike upon it, the they're accusing the IAEA of not doing enough to condemn the actions of Israel. Tehran will limit its cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency over what it calls its silence regarding Israeli strikes. Israeli jet bombers, they bombed nuclear and military facilities in Iran on Friday. Iran denies having a military nuclear program, and they responded by saying bombing is tantamount to a declaration of war, and launched its own strikes against Israel. Tehran suspended nuclear relations or negotiations with the U.S., and the next round had originally been scheduled for today. We have decided that from now on, we will no longer announce the details of our nuclear activities to the agency in advance. This part of a review of the level of our cooperation, which will no longer be the same as before. We have always maintained the transparent, peaceful nuclear program. But when the agency and its board of governors remain silent in the face of Israeli aggression, or issue resolutions influenced by political pressure, we can no longer maintain the same level of cooperation. Interesting, huh? Without directly blaming Israel, the IAEA released a statement Friday stressing that attacks on civilian sites are illegal under international law, and they call for dialogue between the parties. The international watchdog previously reported finding uranium traces at locations Iran had not declared as nuclear sites, and on Thursday formally accused the Islamic Republic of breaching its non-proliferation obligation. Tehran has rejected the allegations as politically motivated. Isn't that crazy? Here's probably the scariest thing of all. Think about this. In the world of sanctions, where Europe is attempting to say and attempting to hold the price for Russian oil at $45 a barrel, Iraq is now warning of prices of $300 a barrel. How do you like that? Escalating tension in the Middle East and a potential, we better get some oil going here in the United States, friends and neighbors, because it's going to get pretty hairy. Escalating tensions in the Middle East and potential closure of the Strait of Hormuz would drive oil prices up to $300 a barrel. The highest I remember it has been like, I don't remember even, but not no higher than 200 is the highest ever. Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein warned during a phone conversation with German Foreign Minister Johann Wadepool on Friday, blah, 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 we know about that. According to Hussein, oil prices could surge between $200 and $300 a barrel if military operations continue to break out, which would significantly increase inflation in European countries and complicate oil exports for producing states such as Iraq. On top of that, and this isn't part of the article, this is me, on top of that, nobody wants to buy from Russia except China. So China's going to have a good price. India's going to get a good price through their own pipelines in Russia. And we're going to be just fine if we continue to produce on our own and do something to improve our own without having to buy it from the Middle East. But what about Europe? Europe doesn't want to buy from Russia, and they're holding the prices artificially low. What does that do? Not a whole lot for them. Because now they'll have to pay the much higher prices of getting it through the Strait of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz, a key transport route, would result in the loss of approximately 5 million barrels a day from the Gulf and Iraqi oil supplies on the global market. Makes me wish I had a couple hundred thousand in my back pocket. We'd put it on some put options or some call options that are way high up, and it depends on which one you're going. The Strait of Hormuz is critical maritime passage through which 20% of the world's oil supply flows. Remember me reading you last year about they're trying to create, China is trying to create a overland rail to avoid the Strait of Hormuz too, through countries friendly to China that would get it to Europe, to the other side, through the same place as the Strait of Hormuz. I haven't checked the status on that in a while, but I might have to. Analysts highlight the potential impact of such closure on global prices. JP Morgan estimates that in a severe scenario, oil would surge to $130 a barrel. Other experts suggest that a complete blockade would push prices much higher, with some forecasts really at $300 a barrel. Brent crude prices rose 7% on Friday to $74 a barrel in response to the attacks. So Russia's going to benefit from this regardless. While Israel has not targeted Iran's main oil export facilities, analysts warn that future strikes would severely impact oil. Conversely, the Islamic Republic could retaliate by disrupting oil shipments through the Strait of Hormuz. Meanwhile, back at the ranch in Russia, the head of the Federation's Council Information Policy Commission, Alexei Pushkov, has said that the conflict between Israel and Iran could lead to significant increases in oil prices due to Tehran's possible blocking of the Persian Gulf. Remember how big Iran is and the control that they do have. So, I don't know. This is getting frightening, friends and neighbors. This is getting real. I'm not sure where we're going to go from here. I just don't know. I already told you about the bodies. We're coming to the end of the shoe, as JR called it. We're coming to the end of the show. And I wanted to see if there was anything more and relevant. I thought it was funny, and I know JR will do this tomorrow, but I'm going to listen to him, and hopefully he will, about the U.S. Republicans investigating the California governor and the L.A. mayor. JR usually knows quite a bit about that stuff, and I like listening to it. So if you get a chance tomorrow, peeps, you should listen to Damn Radio, which you can do all the time at damradio.com/live, and you can get great music when one of us isn't on gabbing one way or the other. But JR will be on tomorrow with some good news for us. If you ever want to check the schedule, you can do that at damradio.com/schedule. Tomorrow is, of course, Monday. This is my first show of the week, the first show of the week. And it's me. Internationalflavor.com is where you can find past shows, all uploaded as a podcast, and you can do the same thing and find them on damradio.com/podcast, and you can listen to them. Tomorrow, you have the Shield Maidens of Missouri, a really big shoe. Looks like Jack's Car Show will be on tomorrow night, and I'll be back tomorrow night at the old 9 p.m. Tuesday, we have a really big shoe, and me, and on Wednesday, our big day five shows, Friends and Neighbors, which you should listen to. We have the Damn Swag. We have the Gabby Hayes Show. We have a really big shoe with JR the Man. We have Ike Skelton's radio show, which I like listening to at 6 to 8 p.m. And I wander my fat butt in again at 9 p.m. come Wednesday. So I suggest you pay attention and listen to more. And what else can I talk about to get to the... We have less than a minute remaining. I like having you here. What do we got? Oh, we have some good songs coming up. We have L.A. Woman. We have Rush. I love Rush, Finding My Way. We have the Blues Brothers, Motley Crue, Fish, and Stone Sour. I don't know that one, but I do know all the rest. I appreciate you being on the show tonight. Please tune in tomorrow at 9 p.m. It'll be me. I will get some further information for you, and we can talk some more. But I'm interested in this investigation about Gavin Newsom and Mayor Karen Bass regarding disinformation and failure to act. Have a very